Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It's Sunday, March 10th. I'm Margaret Brennan, and this is Face the Nation. They're off and running in campaign 2020.
This campaign, with your help, is about transforming this country and creating an economy and a government that works for all, not just the 1%.
So what's different about this field from years past?
I always like to jokingly say, may the best woman win.
And why have some ideological differences become dirty words for Democrats?
So in these questions of capitalist versus socialist, we put you down as a capitalist.
Put me down as a capitalist.
So if you get labeled as a socialist...
Well, it's just wrong.
Would you call yourself a proud capitalist? Oh, I don't know. Again, the labels, I'm not sure any of them fit.
R. Ed O'Keefe asked Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren about her proposal to break up big technology companies. And we'll also hear from another 2020 candidate, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. And as Washington awaits developments in the investigations into the Trump administration and the 2016 campaign, the president's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, defends himself against accusations that he had lied to Congress for a second time.
I have never asked for, nor would I accept, a pardon from President Trump.
That Michael Cohen lied about the pardon. That was a stone-cold lie.
The president later tweeted that Cohen, quote, directly asked me for a pardon. I said no. We'll talk to former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe and a key presidential defender on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Louisiana's John Kennedy. Plus, we'll have analysis on all the news of the week coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. We begin this morning with the already packed field of potential candidates for 2020. And there are signs that former Vice President Joe Biden is planning to enter the race next month. A new poll out this morning shows him leading in Iowa, with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders close behind. A handful of those candidates appeared over the weekend at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. CBS News political correspondent Ed O'Keefe caught up with one of the big names in the race, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and asked about her new proposal to break up tech companies like Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook.
The giant tech companies right now are eating up little tiny businesses, startups, and competing unfairly. Look at it this way. Someone like Amazon runs a platform, you know, the place where you buy your coffee maker and get it delivered in 48 hours. And that's great. But in addition to that, they're sucking up all that information about every purchase, every sale, and every one of the other little businesses that are offering their products on Amazon. And when Amazon sees one that's profitable, they say, think we'll go into business against them now that they've got all this extra information. And they put their own business out there to compete on selling coffee makers, put themselves on page one, put the competitor back on page six, and the competitor's business is just gone. So what I'm saying is we got to break these guys apart. You want to run a platform? That's fine. You don't get to run a whole bunch of the businesses as well. You want to run a business? That's fine. You don't get to run the platform. Think of it this way. It's like in baseball. You can be the umpire or you can own one of the teams. But you don't get to be the umpire and own the teams.
And let me just get this clear. If you had your way, Facebook would have to sell off Instagram. Mm-hmm. Amazon would have to sell off Whole Foods.
All those little businesses that they're running, competing businesses. Yep.
Who is the federal government to tell these companies they have to do that?
There's antitrust law that's been around for more than 100 years. And the federal government has done this many times. For example, broke up Standard Oil, broke up the great monopolies of the late 19th century and early 20th century. And the reason for that is so that we can keep a competitive economy.
This idea has gotten a lot of criticism.
From?
Howard Schultz, the guy who's thinking about running as an independent.
Billionaire, right?
Yes. And he suggested that your proposal is, quote, inconsistent with our free enterprise system, and said that it's emblematic of Democrats proposing, his word, fantasy ideas that will never be implemented. And that instead, perhaps you could just find ways to discuss with these companies ways to make it more competitive.
You mean we could ask these multi-billion dollar companies nicely if they would not eat up the competition and just behave better in the marketplace? Really? We've had laws around against antitrust activity and predatory pricing for over 100 years because we understand that the way markets work are when there's real competition in that market.
And you know that this kind of proposal feeds into the arguments that Republicans have been making to label Democrats as anti-capitalist, adopting these socialist ideas.
The reality is, it is not capitalism to have one giant that comes in and dominates, a monopolist that dominates a market. What I have supported all the way through are the kinds of things that help level the playing field. So I think a level playing field says that the big guys have to pay, kind of like everybody else does, and they have to pay to help create some opportunities for them.
But you know you're getting labeled, and you're getting coupled in with a few of your other Democratic contenders as someone who supports socialist ideas. Do we describe you as a capitalist? What's the best way to describe you?
I believe in markets. Markets that work, markets that have a cop on the beat and have real rules and everybody follows them. I believe in a level playing field.
So if you get labeled as a socialist?
Well, it's just wrong.
Silicon Valley has obviously been a reliable source of Democratic financial support, especially in recent cycles. Given this proposal, are you going to decline financial support from tech executives or tech employees if they decide to get to your campaign?
Look, nobody's been beaten down the door, but let me be clear. I'm not in Washington to work for billionaires. I'm in Washington to help level the playing field so that everybody gets a chance to get out there and compete. Right now, with giants like Amazon and Google and Facebook, do you know how venture capitals talk about the space around them? They call it the kill zone because they don't want to fund businesses in that space because they know Amazon will eat them up, Facebook will eat them up, Google will eat them up. We need a chance for every one of the young people in that room to thrive, to get their idea out there. And if it turns out to be the next Google, good for them.
You said nobody's beating down the door. How is fundraising going for you?
As far as I know, it's going great. You know, it's a lot of small dollar fundraisers, and here's been the fun part. I've actually been calling people who donated $25, $5, $50, $10, and had some great conversations with folks. I get a chance to ask them, what pulled you into this? And people talk about the things that matter most to them.
The House this past week had to vote on a resolution condemning hate of all sorts because of what one congresswoman had said, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota.
I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country.
Many considered it anti-Semitic. Others said it's being misinterpreted. What's your view on what she said?
Look, my view is that we condemn anti-Semitism and Islamophobia wherever it appears. We are a democracy. And in a democracy, we have to talk about our differences. We need to do so with respect. But ultimately, we need to hammer out the best policies for this country. And that means a lot of frank and full discussion.
Was she unfairly targeted?
Look, right now what we've got is a condemnation of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and other forms of hatred. Hatred is not how we build a democratic dialogue.
Ed's full interview with Senator Warren is available on our website, facethenation.com. Now, the latest candidate to enter the race to beat President Trump is former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. He announced his candidacy Thursday.
I'm not the first person in the race or the most well-known person in the race. But let me tell you, at four syllables and 12 letters, Hickenlooper is now the biggest name in the race.
And now the biggest name in the race joins us live from Austin. Governor, welcome to Face the Nation.
Thanks for having me on.
Is it a good idea to do what Senator Warren is advocating there with breaking up big tech companies?
Well, I think you've got to look at the environment and how the system is working. And for several decades now, increasingly, people in the middle class and poor people in this country haven't had the security and opportunity that our economic system used to create for them. So what is the reason why we're seeing such a large number, a decline in the number of startups, people starting businesses? And maybe some of that is due to these large companies that, usually when someone's going to start a business, they're already a successful employee somewhere. Maybe they're looking at that landscape and saying, these companies are too big, I can't get in. And I think that's one of the arguments that she's trying to make. We have to make sure that we have a competitive system whereby little guys feel they've got a decent chance to succeed.
So you do think tech companies have too much influence over the economy?
No, what I'm saying is that they are, in many circumstances, becoming so large that they make it harder for small companies to compete. I'm not, again, to make a blanket statement about all tech companies, they're too big, I think that would be a little bit over going too far. But I do think it's legitimate to say, how do we make sure that we have more competition in such a way that we encourage, people to start their own businesses? That's where job creation happens, is when you get small businesses. People like me, I got laid off and I ended up starting first one restaurant company, then another restaurant company. Then, I took old warehouses and turned them into loft projects. But we created thousands of jobs in that process. And we're able to, stimulate a whole part of Denver and other, cities and towns across the Midwest. That's what drives this country and always has. And we're seeing a decline in the number of people willing to start up businesses.
Well, I want to offer you the chance to clear something up here, because you did an interview earlier in the week where you were asked three times if you would call yourself a proud capitalist. And you wouldn't directly answer the question. It led Howard Schultz, who's possibly a candidate, to say, if even a successful businessman and entrepreneur like Governor Hickenlooper can't openly support capitalism in the Democratic primary, it's clear this is Senator Sanders' party now. Why are you uncomfortable calling yourself a proud capitalist?
Well, the point I was making is that we define people by these labels that often have all kinds of associations and baggage with them. In that sense, do I believe in small business? Of course I believe in small business. I started probably more than 20 different small businesses. I'd have, in 1 year, I'd have over 1 million customers. I understand that. But what's happening? I think it's kind of a silly question. We should be looking at some of the reasons behind why we have less and less startups. We should look at some of the reasons why, more and more people aren't wanting to start a business.
Sure, but you understand that it is a main Republican talking point to label Democrats right now as anti-business socialists.
Right, but that's ridiculous. Obviously,
so you would reject
the
that.
The Democratic Party is a big tent.
You reject that label.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's not accurate. And I think that as your interview with Elizabeth Warren showed, there are all kinds of different people making up the Democratic Party. And do I believe in free markets? Do I believe that, you put capital to work to create jobs and improve your community? Back when I was a kid, businesses understood that part of their job wasn't just to make as much profit as they could, but it was to create the community. Once you get back into these labels, am I a capitalist? Am I a socialist? How much of a capitalist am I versus how much of a socialist? That becomes kind of silly, doesn't it?
Well,
in a funny way.
The other candidates were comfortable answering the question, so I wanted to offer you a chance to answer it. I understand you're not comfortable directly answering it, but I want to move on to
I'm comfortable. I'm happy.
Go ahead.
Let me just, I'm happy to say I'm a capitalist, but I think at a certain point, the labels do nothing but divide us.
Okay.
And what I'm trying to build this campaign around is to say that, that as a country, we've got to stop finding every excuse to divide ourselves.
Point taken.
And begin working together because we've got some big issues to make.
Point taken. In terms of your platform, I understand you support universal health care, not necessarily Medicaid for all, Medicare for all. You've supported some free trade deals in the past, like NAFTA. You've touted your executive experience in a field full of legislators here. You don't like labels, but you sound like more of a centrist. How do you keep the Democratic Party from splintering further?
Well, by trying to avoid these all the labeling that goes on, you know, I mean, I'm running for president because I believe I can beat Donald Trump, but I also believe I can bring us together on the other side and begin getting stuff done. And that's one thing I think that I bring to the table is I'm a doer. I'm not someone who's, I mean, I'm a dreamer too, and I believe in big visions. We've done some amazing things in Colorado. I mean, we've almost got universal health care coverage in Colorado now. We've addressed some of the biggest root causes of climate change. We've taken this our economy from 40th in job creation to being the number one economy in the country for the last couple of years. Those are things that I think should be models on who the next, you know, what the next president needs to be able to demonstrate, that they can do things.
Right. Well, Governor, thank you very much for joining us. Former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, he is the author of a new book, The Threat, How the FBI Protects America in the Age of Terror and Trump. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Start you off on some of the news of the week. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort was sentenced this week. He will also face sentencing in a D.C. court in the days to come. He was given 47 months, far less than what is the sentencing guideline of up to 20 plus years. Is the length of time he will serve matching the crimes he's being accused of?
Well, I was really surprised by the sentence he was given. I think it's an incredibly lenient sentence in light not just of the offenses he was convicted for, but the additional offenses that he has pled guilty to in D.C. and the offenses he's acknowledged essentially in the sentencing process in Virginia that he's responsible for. So, like most people, I was shocked by how lenient the sentence was.
So it sounds like you're predicting that the D.C. court may add to those 47 months?
Well, there's no question he's going to get additional time from D.C. I don't think it's probably the job of the D.C. courts to rectify a mistake or something that was done in another jurisdiction. I'm sure that Judge Jackson will approach her sentence with just keeping her eye on the facts of that case. But there's no doubt he'll get additional time from that process.
In your book, The Threat, you write about some of the president's public comments about Paul Manafort in particular, and you frame it in one passage as possible witness tampering. You say you fear a judge will be influenced by some of the president's comments. Did you have any sense that that's what happened here with Judge Ellis?
I don't. But the point that I try to make in the book is that is to try to highlight how incredibly irresponsible and indeed corrosive statements like that from the chief executive are on the process and on the public's perception of the fairness and the effectiveness of the process. When the president engages in messaging like that, people can't help but step back and ask themselves that question that you just asked. Did that have an impact on the process or on the result in this case? We don't know the answer to that, but it introduces a level of doubt and insecurity into a system that we all need to depend upon to being fair and free.
The charges that Paul Manafort faced were in regard to financial crimes. Do you believe that he was a Russian asset?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that Mr. Manafort's extensive involvement with Ukrainian and Russian actors is highly suspicious. I think that that's something that we'll wait to see what the Mueller team opines on with their final conclusions.
Because the president seized on a comment made by Judge Ellis, who seemed to be just pointing out that the Russian potential links were not actually part of the trial that we have seen underway here. So you're saying there the president's comments were not actually accurate.
Well, that shouldn't be a surprise. I think that Judge Ellis was very careful to indicate that he was sentencing Mr. Manafort for the conduct that was before him. And Mr. Manafort was not charged in that case with being an agent for the government of Russia. So I think Judge Ellis's efforts to be careful and tailor his words are far from an exoneration of Mr. Manafort on any other potential charges.
I want to ask you as well about Michael Cohen, the president's longtime attorney. And we played in the open some of the tape showing the changing stories here in regard to right. whether there was discussion or not of a presidential pardon. Now it appears, according to the president, that it was discussed. As an investigator, what do you make of that?
Very, very hard to sort through a basically he said argument between two people who have very challenged credibility. At the end of the day, the strength of Michael Cohen's testimony, potential testimony, is derived not from what he's telling us now, but rather from whatever facts and corroborative evidence the prosecutors were able to glean from that treasure trove of documents and recordings and other things that we've heard so much about.
You're saying don't take him at his word, take him by the evidence he presents.
That's right.
I want to ask you as well, because, of course, the president constantly mentions the credibility that you have and
sure.
calls that into question, specifically on the text between Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, which mm-hmm. is something the president often comments on. You were asked about this on CNN by Anderson Cooper, and you said you had no recollection of the meeting that was referred to in one of the text exchange between those two individuals, which mentioned an insurance policy in case Trump got elected. Do you know why you were personally mentioned in those texts?
I don't. Lisa Page, Pete Strzok, and I, and many other members of that investigative team met in my office and conference rooms around FBI headquarters all the time, right? So it was an intensive investigation that required a lot of attention and a lot of involvement. So I can't sit here and tell you years later the circumstances of exactly that instance that they seem to be referring to in that text. I also wasn't a participant in that text, so I can't add too much more to your understanding of it. I know that Peter has described in his own congressional testimony what he was referring to, and I take him at his word for that description.
Because the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, has been on this program, specifically referred to those texts and said that it is proof that you, along with Strzok and Page, showed political bias and a political agenda, and that's why he wants to call you before the committee mm-hmm. to answer some questions. So one of the other texts there was a quote that said, "We need to open the case we've been waiting on now while Andy is acting." While you were acting FBI mm-hmm. director. Do you know what case this is? Why would it matter that you were in that acting role?
Well, again, I can't tell you what Lisa and Pete were referring to in their private texts. I think I've been very clear publicly about how the investigators felt about the work that we mm-hmm. needed to do in May of 2017 after Director Comey was fired. They made a recommendation to me that we open cases. I acted on that recommendation. I felt very strongly at that time that I needed to make those decisions quickly because mm-hmm. I anticipated I would not be in the acting role for very long, and I didn't know who would be coming in behind me or how they would handle the ongoing investigation that we thought was important to conclude.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
We go now to Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy, who is in New Orleans this morning. Senator, I want to give you a chance to respond to Andy McCabe.
Let me say first, Margaret, I'm still in a bit of a stupor at Mayor Hickenlooper's shame at having once been a capitalist. I've seen it all now, but I'll save that for another day. Mr. McCabe. Mr. McCabe is one of the people responsible for politicizing the premier law enforcement agency in the history of the world, the FBI. He's not the only one, but it's clear that he and others in 2016, some were for Trump, some mm-hmm. were for Clinton, but they acted on their political beliefs. And they hurt the FBI badly for that, all of them.
We got
not just Mr. McCabe, but all of them should hang their head in shame and hang their head, put their head in a bag.
Senator, you were responding to Andrew McCabe, the former deputy FBI director, who has described himself as a lifelong Republican. But laid out here his deep concern about the president and his actions.
Well, let me say it again. There were, and perhaps still are, some people at the FBI, one of whom was Mr. McCabe, who helped politicize the agency. When an FBI agent knocks at your door, you shouldn't have to worry about whether you're a Democrat or Republican and whether that makes a difference. And Mr. McCabe has helped politicize that agency. And that's wrong. He should be ashamed, and he should hide his head in a bag. And
what
we
do you
have
mean,
got
politicized?
To clean house over there.
Clean house?
Well,
what do you mean by that?
Mr. McCabe, well, let me back up and say this, Margaret. I'm talking about people over there who were both for Trump and for Clinton. Now, they're entitled to have a personal opinion, but they're not entitled to act on it or leave the impression that they acted on it. And I think McCabe did that. I think he's part of a group over there that think they're smarter and more virtuous than the American people. And I think it hurt the FBI badly. Mr. McCabe is also, at the present time, playing the role of huckster. He's trying to sell a book. And he was fired for lying to his fellow FBI agents. Well, now, if you and I lie to the FBI, we go to jail. If an FBI agent lies to the FBI, you get fired.
Just short of his ability to actually get his pension. Some would say it was politically motivated firing of him.
He's lucky he wasn't prosecuted, Margaret.
For what?
And I'm not saying this because McCabe is obviously pro-Trump.
What would he have been prosecuted for? Pro-Clinton.
For perjury. For lying to an FBI agent. He did it repeatedly. Now, if you and I do that, we go to jail.
Are you?
He just got fired. He was lucky.
And so I guess this is a preview of the questioning that we will hear of him before the Senate Judiciary Committee if he is called to testify, as Senator Graham has said. But I want to ask you about, since you sit on that committee as well, the sentencing we saw this week of a Trump campaign chairman, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. He was charged with an array of felonies, financial crimes. Federal sentencing guidelines would have had him serving upwards of 20 years. He got 47 months. Does the punishment fit the array of crimes?
All right. Before I answer your question, let me be clear about Mr. McCabe. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. If you're at the FBI, you're not supposed to act on it. Mr. McCabe did, and I believe he's one bent two before. Now, number two, Mr. Manafort.
Can I just clarify, you in the past have said, I thought, that you supported the Mueller probe. McCabe had helped to set up some of the special counsel there specifically to look at the question of whether the president
I do support the Mueller probe. I do support the Mueller probe, but that doesn't preclude Mr. McCabe from being what he is, a bent two before. And he hurt the FBI badly and all the people over there who tried to help Clinton or who tried to help Trump. Every one of them should hide his head in the bag. They hurt the premier law enforcement agency in all of human history, and we're going to have to spend a lot of time rehabilitating it. The American people don't trust it as much as they used to, and that's wrong.
But you say you
and
still support the Mueller probe itself. Can you answer the question, though, on Paul Manafort?
Manafort was charged with an array of felonies because of the special counsel's case. Number one, I was surprised at his sentence. I thought it would be longer. Number two, as I said in the past, Mr. Manafort is a grifter. He used to be a partner with Roger Stone. I'm sorry, Margaret, he's just a sleazoid. I mean, he's always played at the margins. Number three, you know, rather than just be opinionated, I'd rather be informed. Judge Ellis has been on the bench 30 years. I haven't read the sentencing memos. He obviously believed 4 years was enough. I might disagree with him, but I'd have to read the sentencing memos
first
because there's a lot of stuff in there that you and I don't see.
Lastly, does it trouble you that the president admitted that he had discussed a presidential pardon with Michael Cohen? Should he have been discussing that in an investigation he's involved in?
Well, as I understand it, at least part of the story, Margaret, is that Cohen and or his lawyers approached the president and asked for a pardon.
The president said it happened directly in a direct conversation. That's what the president said.
Well, Mr. Cohen, once again, in front of Congress, lied then. He said that never happened. And I think with Mr. Cohen, given his checkered past, if he's breathing, he's lying. But, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't blame Cohen for asking. It was inappropriate, but he shouldn't have lied to Congress about it.
Senator, good to talk to you today. We turn now to our panel for some political analysis. David Frum writes for The Atlantic. Susan Glasser covers the presidency and foreign policy for The New Yorker. Jerry Seib is the executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. And Tolu Olorunripa covers the White House for The Washington Post. Tolu, did I get it right?
You were pretty close. Olorunripa.
Every time. One of these days I will get it right. Let's start off with just some of what we heard here. Two 2020 presidential candidates, and then one of the things you're going to hear a lot about on the campaign trail, which is the food fight over the Mueller probe and interpretations around it. Tolu, what did you hear from the candidates?
I thought it was really striking to hear Governor Hickenlooper really try to position himself when it came to capitalism versus socialism. He struggled earlier in the week when he was asked about it. He struggled when you asked him about it. He sort of tried to talk about party labels and how labels should not be the focus. But just being able to say, I am a capitalist, when, as you mentioned, Republicans are really trying and going all in on trying to brand Democrats as socialists, for a former businessman and a former governor who has not really toyed around with socialist ideas in the past, for him to struggle, it shows that the Democrats are really trying to figure out how to approach this issue of whether or not capitalism works. And we heard a little bit about that from Senator Warren. She did say that she does believe in markets, and she does believe that capitalism is a positive program when you do have the right rules in place. Mm-hmm. But it is when you have Bernie Sanders getting very big crowds, it's hard for Democrats to figure out sort of how to talk about socialism versus capitalism. And they're going to be hit from the right, from Republicans and from the president, saying that all of them are socialists.
Yeah.
As a Republican, I just marvel at how Democrats trip over their own shoelaces on this. We had President Trump tweet that the communist economy of North Korea, under the dynamic leadership of its dictatorial leader, could achieve unprecedented economic growth. The president routinely picks favorites among companies. He's erecting tariff walls, which are taxes on American exporters. And Democrats can't figure out how to defend a market economy with social insurance programs and let this guy claim the mantle of the champion of free enterprise? Really?
So there's a much more interesting drama beneath the surface that's going on among Democrats, which is, where is the energy in the party? Mm-hmm. Why did we really succeed in 2018? There is a narrative that says we succeeded because the progressive left was full of energy and was out making this happen. We took control of the House because of that. And centrists in the party are going crazy, saying, no, that's not what happened in 2018. What happened in 2018 was Republicans, soft Republican suburban women in districts that Donald Trump carried in 2016 moved over to our side. These were moderate voters that won the House back for us in 2018 in states like Pennsylvania and Minnesota and Virginia. And those are the people we have to go after. And they're not going to be won over with a socialist message. They're moderates. And those are the people who will make the difference in 2020. That's the debate.
It's an interesting theory of the case to go into the California primary advocating for breaking up some of California's biggest businesses, too. What do you make of Warren's strategy there?
Well, I agree with that. I think there's two things to unpack here. One is that Senator Warren is a very accomplished promoter of her ideas and of her ideology. But I think the other thing that's happening in the Democratic Party right now is the Trump style of politics is being introduced. So you have basically the debate of ideas, and Jerry's right. There's a huge debate inside the party about the best way to appeal to the voters that they need to appeal to in order to defeat Trump. That's one debate, but it's not purely about ideas, right? A lot of it is about style, and that's where I think you see the most pronounced shift. Are we headed towards a Tea Party of the left? I think that's what connects the dots between some of what's happening inside Congress this week and what's happening with some of these 2020 candidates. And you see people like John Hickenlooper visibly uncomfortable with the new style of politics. Elizabeth Warren, I think, is a very interesting character, right? Her politics are not wildly different from those of Bernie Sanders, but her style is dramatically different. On your show, I was just struck by how calm and measured she is, how very, she is, remember, a former Harvard Law School professor, and she appears to be that way, and it's very different than the sort of Bernie Sanders, shouting politics. And I think that's what fundamentally, as much as ideology, is a conflict around the kind of party. Are we going to have a demagogue of the left to take upon a populist right-wing demagogue, which is what the president of the United States is, basically?
Tolu, how do we understand the showdown among House Democrats over Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's remarks?
Yeah, House Democrats did not want to spend this week talking about anti-Semitism. They had a number of different bills that they were putting through. But because they are struggling with this internecine battle between the progressive progressives and the base and the moderates and the leadership that is a little bit older, you have religious lines, you have racial lines, you have generational lines that the Democrats are struggling over, and they haven't quite figured out how to balance the very diverse class that they have. And I think that's part of the reason you saw Nancy Pelosi wanted to start off with a very tough resolution, specifically comment on Ilhan Omar's comments. But then she got a lot of pushback from 2020 candidates, from some of the progressive base who said that this was unfairly singling out, you know, a Muslim congresswoman, one of the few African-American women in Congress, and one of the few freshmen in Congress. And I think that was part of the reason that they decided to make it a much more broad statement and looked at not only anti-Semitism, but anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-LGBT action. And I think that was part of the reason why the Democrats spent the whole week sort of trying to figure out where they can find some sort of balance in the party.
And this was red meat for Republicans, certainly the president. He tried to label Democrats anti-Jewish.
He did try that, which is certainly eyebrow raising. I think what is going on here is that when you have a big intake in any party in a year, you pick up a lot of people who are ready for prime time and a lot of people who are not. And I think one of the questions that is going to face progressive Democrats is who here wants to be inside the building making the decisions? And who wants to be outside the building carrying the placards? And that people will pick different career paths. And I think you can see from the extraordinarily careful and targeted and self-effacing questioning that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did in the Cohen hearings versus the unbelievably undisciplined, repeated, provocative remarks of Ilhan Omar and the rather sad defenses of her by Democratic leadership. You know, you have to understand she doesn't quite know what words mean. If you don't know what words mean, Congress may be the wrong line of work for you.
Well, David, I want to ask you to tee up the piece you just wrote for The Atlantic.
Yes, thank you.
Great read. But it's a topic that kind of touches some of these very hot-button issues as well, crossing race, crossing a number of things that seem to even divide Democrats,
yes.
And that is how to deal with the challenge of population growth and influx of people either across the border or just into this country.
So one of the things that is a real casualty of the Trump years, the articles about immigration and argue specifically that the United States and other developed countries, from a social point of view, need less of it, even as their economies are clamoring for more of it. And the argument of the piece is this is about preserving social stability. What has happened is immigration, and I blame President Trump for this, has become a culture war issue rather than a social stability issue. And so it's not a binary question. It's not, you know, open the borders or have none. And it's not something you can any one country can manage on its own without reference to other countries. Immigration is a system, and you have to manage it as a system. And our ability, and when I say our, not just America, but you see this across the developed world, to think rationally about things, to stand up for the interests of the citizens of the country. That's who you governments are answer to, not to the world, but to their own citizens. How do you do something that stands the test and is not just driven by the imperatives of business? I think the greatest single line ever written about this problem was written by a Swiss writer who said, "We wanted workers, we got people instead." And I think we need to understand that you are choosing the future population of your country. If you choose wisely, immigration can be a great source of strength. If you choose poorly, it can rip your society apart and empower the most extreme elements in your own society.
And you say this as an immigrant yourself.
And I am born in Canada. I was naturalized in 2007.
You know, I think what everybody knows and nobody will actually acknowledge is that the problem here isn't immigration. It's the immigration system is broken. It doesn't work. It hasn't really been upgraded since 1986. If everybody would step back from the emotion, they would agree that what's needed is comprehensive immigration reform, not this many immigrants or that many immigrants. That's not happening. And that's the problem of the paralysis in this city, I think.
Well, it's the death of, you know, technocracy. It's the death of rational policy debate. I mean,
right.
You know, you can have all the reasonable, rational arguments you want for immigration reform. It's interesting. I had a conversation the other day with a former senior official in the Bush administration. Was that the key domestic policy failure of the Bush administration, putting aside the Iraq war, was to not pursue comprehensive immigration reform, but to go for social security reform first. I think we'll all look back on that. The deal that was available then, obviously, we would be in a very different place in our politics right now had that occurred.
But comprehensive immigration reform usually is code for more. And the right answer is less. And that the right answer is not zero, but the right answer is less, it seems to me. Yes, it's true that technocracy and evidence-based decision-making, it's had a bad bunch of innings. And people who advocate this this approach, we have a lot of failures on our hands. I mean, we're watching the Brexit debate. That's a reaction to, you know, the financial crisis and to the euro crisis and euro failures, the failures of the Iraq war and the Bush administration, of which I was a part. But for all its failures, prejudice and impulsiveness and yelling at people and symbols, that has an even worse record than evidence-based decision-making.
Well, immigration can be its own show another day. We have so much more to talk about, but we have to leave it there. Thanks to all of you. We're now joined by former Deputy Secretary of State William Burns. He's the author of a new book, The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Welcome to Face the Nation.
Margaret, it's great to be with you.
I hope this isn't saying that American diplomacy is dead.
No, it's not dead at all. In fact, I think it matters more than ever on today's international landscape, which is a lot more crowded and competitive in some ways than ever before. My concern is just that I think we're drifting right now, and that's the case for renewing diplomacy.
Well, I want to ask you specifically on the topic of Russia, because you spent a lot of time in Russia, you speak Russian, and you had a number of documents declassified for the book that you wrote, revealing private conversations you had. And one of them, you write about a one-on-one you had with Vladimir Putin in 2007. It stands out because he essentially, to you, to your face, threatened the U.S. If the U.S. interfered in their election, saying, don't think we won't react to outside interference. In hindsight, was that a preview of what happened in 2016?
It was a little bit of a preview, I think. You know, I mean, Putin is a very combustible combination, I think, of grievance and ambition and insecurity. And he's convinced that the United States has been trying to undermine his regime and the Kremlin, you know, going back to the color revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia 15 years ago. Now, the truth, of course, is those revolutions were about Ukrainians and Georgians, not Americans. But Putin came to the conviction that we were out to undermine him. And Putin, in my experience, is an apostle of payback. And so when he saw an opportunity in 2016 to take advantage of dysfunction and polarization in our own political system and interfere and sow chaos, he took advantage of it.
You talk a lot about the Trump administration towards the end of the book. And when it comes to Vladimir Putin, you basically say the president has a very wrong-headed approach to think that flattery or trying to be friends with Putin is going to get him anywhere.
No, I mean, I think foreign policy diplomacy, as you well know, is about advancing American interests. It's not about getting along with people. And I think if you saw the, you know, the summit press conference between Trump and Putin in Helsinki, what you saw was, you know, a really embarrassing attempt by President Trump to ingratiate himself with Putin and throw his own intelligence and law enforcement agencies under the bus. I think Putin reads that as a sign of manipulability, a sign of weakness that he'll try to take advantage of.
Now, I want to point out to our viewers, because, you know, you're not a talking head. You're a career diplomat.
Right.
You did this for 33 years, five presidents, 10 secretaries of state you served under. You speak Russian, you speak Arabic, you speak French. You've got a slew of awards from the intel community and the State Department. And they lay that out to say you were very careful in choosing your words. And when you write about the Trump administration, you say it has diminished American influence on a shifting international landscape, hollowed out American diplomacy, and only deepened the divisions among Americans about our global role. Has the president hurt U.S. national security?
Well, I'm concerned that, just as I wrote in the book, that what you're seeing in this administration, especially from President Trump himself, is a worldview and a set of actions that are undermining our stature and our influence in the world. And it has real corrosive effect right now, I think. The truth is, President Trump didn't invent a lot of the problems on that landscape or a lot of concerns within our own society, but I think he's making them worse right now, too. This is a moment when the United States is no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block. It's a moment when diplomacy, when our alliances, our capacity for building coalitions of countries, what sets us apart from lonelier powers like China and Russia, is more important than ever. And my concern is that we're squandering those assets right now.
Do you applaud his attempt at diplomacy with North Korea?
I do. I think the effort, including the effort to engage directly with North Korea's leader, is started out as an admirable effect. I think the concern I have right now is that in the second summit meeting in Hanoi, we're giving Kim Jong-un an unearned boost in his stature. And I think we need to take advantage of the disappointment in Hanoi to reset our approach on North Korea.
Now, you helped lead the back channel talks that began the secret negotiations mm-hmm. with Iran that ultimately led to the nuclear deal. President Trump pulled out of that. It still exists in some form, with the Europeans at least. What happens next to that deal? Do you see the U.S. on a trajectory to have a direct clash with Iran?
Yeah, my concern is that, you know, given the law of inadvertent collisions, we can bang into the Iranians, or our allies and friends can. There's so many combustible parts of the landscape in the Middle East right now. And that can set off a chain of escalation that can be very difficult to control. I do think it was a huge mistake to pull out of the Iran deal. I think it was the best of the available alternatives to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And I think pulling out has added to the fissures between us and our closest European allies. In a way, it's done Vladimir Putin's work for him. And I think it's also eroded the long-term value of sanctions as an instrument of American foreign policy, simply because by unilaterally pushing for sanctions rather than working with our partners, you know, we open up another area of vulnerability.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
The book is The Back Channel by Bill Burns. That's it for us today. Thank you for watching. Until next week, from Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were Democratic presidential candidates Elizabeth Warren, John Hickenlooper, along with former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, plus Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Allison Hawley. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow the show and CBS News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m., 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.